Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and editor Simon Lambert today is deputy editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, the five false economies to avoid as inflation bites. Our Simon tells us why you shouldn't bin the budget, not pay your bills, or skip your pension. Also today, the buy-to-let battleground. Tensions between landlords and tenants are at boiling point as rising rates, extra rules, and lack of rental homes drive up prices. But was this a problem years in the making? Plus, new savings Best Buy alert, and with energy prices so high, are electric cars any cheaper to run than petrol? Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, not a day goes by without more bad news about the rising cost of living. The energy price cap going up 80% in October and God knows where after that. Inflation could reach over 20% next year. Food prices rising at the fastest rate since the financial crash. It goes on. A raft of social media campaigns, though, are telling us not to pay our bills. The temptation as well is to cut back on our pension contributions and bin our budgets. But is this wise? Simon says not. He has put together five false economies to avoid as inflation bites. Simon, welcome back from your break. What is it all about?
Well, it's about these bills going up and this cost of living crisis that we've been talking about for a long time now, but is really, really going to start to bite, I think, in about a month's time for a lot of people. And the cost of living crisis is a tricky subject to navigate, and one that we have talked about on many times because it's got a lot of different layers to it. For some people, there genuinely is a crisis. They actually cannot make ends meet. They cannot afford to eat. They're going to food banks. They can't afford to heat their homes and all these other things. And then there's, you know, the chunk of people in the middle above them for whom it's a crisis might be stretching things. But I probably, you know, staring down the barrel of all this bad news, it feels a lot like one. And if you look at how much people's bills are going to go up by, they're looking at maybe paying a few hundred pounds more a month on their energy come October than they were a year earlier, at the same time as they're paying more for fuel for the car, they're paying more for food, they're paying more for pretty much everything. And it's a big squeeze. And I think that even once you go above those people in the middle to the people at the top, certainly almost everyone I speak to is largely complaining about the cost of everything going up and how much it's costing them to do things. And to put a bit of context on this from my own personal perspective, come October, my energy inefficient 1960s house is going to see our monthly gas and electricity bills go up from about £150 that we were paying last winter when we were still on our fixed price deal to about £550. So it's about £400 a month extra that we're going to be paying. Now, I don't have £400 a month spare, so to speak, and I'm in a relatively fortunate financial position. Okay, so this is really gonna squeeze people. But before I go on to these tips, I guess maybe we should just quantify this kind of like who's got this money to spare, because I remember Rachel Rickard Strauss, formerly of This Is Money and of this podcast, always used to have a bit of an issue when we mentioned spare money. And it's something that you see written all over the place and mentioned all the time. It's like people's, you know, this spare money each month. And it's like she always said, people don't have spare money. They always have something they intend to do with that money. It's very unlikely that you've got, for the vast majority of people, they have spare money, so to speak. And that's where this is going to hit, because that money that is going out extra on bills is going to have to come from somewhere. And you might have that money spare, in inverted commas, each month. But when you say spare, that might be the money that you're saving and investing every month, the money that you're putting aside for your future. Or some of it might be the money that's going into your pension, a much more long-term plan and a much more organized plan than most people's saving and investing. Or it might be the money that you put aside every month to go on holiday. It might be some of the money that you're putting aside for the big occasions that you've got coming up over the year, or you're saving for something in particular. Maybe you're saving for a life event. For people who are younger, it might be that they're saving for a wedding, a first home deposit, or things like that. For other people who are older and have children, they might be saving for their children, they might be saving for their grandchildren, they might be saving outside of a pension for their retirement, all of these other things. And this money that people are going to have to find is going to have to come from somewhere. And if you are someone who's in the fortunate position where you are able to save and invest and go on holiday maybe once, twice, three times a year, you got yourself a car that you've got a monthly payment on, or all those other things, you're going to have to find one of those places to get this money from. And the really, really, really annoying thing about this money is you're not going to get anything in return. You're just going to get the same thing that you got before: your home heated and your electricity paid for. And actually, you're probably going to have to do a little bit less of the heating, and you're going to be running around the house switching lights off after people. And I always find this one of the most annoying things about some of life's expenses, such as car tax, MOTs, and car insurance, right? I'll take the MOT out of that because that's just checking your car's safe, right? But car tax and car insurance, they're really quite expensive, and they don't make your car work any better. It's really annoying. If my car tax or my car insurance made my car faster or more efficient or handle better or do something like that, I'd have much less of a problem paying it. But it doesn't. It just goes straight out the window. And that's the thing with these energy bill price rises, right? It's just money's just going straight out the window. And it's the worst thing is it's not even going into the economy. It's not going into, you know, at least if shop prices are going up at some point, you're hoping that the shop is making a bit more money and that's going to feed through to its staff and it's going to stimulate the economy and stuff. We're just leaking money out of the economy on these energy bill price rises. But we're going to have to find the money to pay for it unless we live in the dark and turn the heating off. And for some people, that's a really unfortunate decision to be making. But I'm not talking about those people, okay? I'm talking more about the people who are probably going to be listening to the different people be in different situations listening to the podcast. But a lot of the people listening to this podcast, a lot of our readers, they're going to be going on holiday a couple of times a year. They're going to be going out for dinner a few times a month. They're going to be going out with friends. They're going to be going out with drinks. They're going to be going to gigs and events and things like that. And they're going to have to, like, ultimately, there's going to come a point where you're going to have to cut back on this. I mean, for example, the old energy bills hike that I'm facing is at least one family holiday's worth of money in a year for a family of four, for which we are. And that's where it really starts to kind of impact your life. And we have to find the money from. But there are, as I said, also some things that people are starting to do that are a false economy. So things like cutting back on the holidays, finding a bit of money from elsewhere, you know, maybe you don't need that expensive car on the PCP. Maybe you can have a couple of less takeaways a month. Maybe you can not go out to dinner twice, all those other things. That is extremely sensible financial planning. Okay. That's like budgeting kind of stuff, but there's also some other moves that you can make that probably aren't quite so sensible.
Well, tell us what they are, Simon, because the way you've outlined this, yes, I think that at the current rate, and even potentially in October, you know, there may be a situation where just cutting back on a few restaurant trips or takeaways may be enough. But with what we're hearing, January, next April, even a lot of the people that you're talking about, our listeners, will probably quite struggle to do a lot of the things that they've done in the past. I mean, you're talking £400 now, that potentially could be £800 extra, you know, in January. Who knows?
Oh, and just to be clear, I'm not spending £400 a month on restaurants and takeaways. I'm not suggesting that I can pluck it all out of that air. But it's
you're doing well.
It's a combination of maybe I need to go out to dinner. I don't actually go out to dinner that much, not like I used to. Probably at one point in my life, I might spend £400 a month on restaurants. Mm. But it's like going out to dinner one time less, having one less takeaway, maybe trimming back your holiday ambitions, and you're diverting some of that money you'd be saving for holiday into just unfortunately paying your monthly bills, saving a bit less money every month because you just can't afford to save as much. It's going to be a combination of all these things that people are going to have to do. I think that's my point.
You've written about don't cut back on saving into your pension or investments or saving at all, but there's going to be people that actually can't do this. So I suppose, where do you prioritize? Tell us first of all about the five false economies.
So the false economies. Okay, the first one, not paying your bills. Right. We've all seen the social media campaigns about this. I'm sure some of us have had conversations with some of our slightly crazier friends, possibly over some form of social media, WhatsApp or something like that, where they're telling us about how they're going to get involved in some form of not paying their bills scenario. And the thing I would say about this not paying your bills thing, I mean, some of it features some highly dubious claims about how legally enforceable some of these payments are, which basically your energy company does actually have the right to force you to pay them for the energy you use, just to be absolutely clear on this position. But stopping paying your bills is not a wise move. It is the first step on a path that can damage your credit rating for a very long time and have a really bad impact on your finances for much longer than you might think, involve mounting debts that can become unmanageable. Because if you're not paying your bills because, you know, you're thinking you can't afford them, well, they're just going to roll up and roll up and roll up, and then they're going to be even worse in the future. Threats from debt collectors, those are never fun, really quite stressful, and lots of other problems. And so if you genuinely can't afford to pay your bills, you need to speak to your utility firm, ask for help, ask for a payment plan. They are in what I heard described by someone as a listening mode at the moment. They want to be seen to be helping people, okay? And if you're really struggling, seek assistance from somewhere like Citizens Advice. But do not just stop paying your bills, okay? Not a good move, right? Don't just do, well, I'm just not going to pay and it'll be fine because my mate down the pub says, da-da-da-da-da. Don't do that, okay? Then there's the only paying for energy you use one, which is a sort of a step on from this not paying your bills thing. This is a slightly tricky issue, because there are quite a few customers out there who feel that energy firms have been asking for way more than they should be on monthly direct debits. And there are also some people I've spoken to who are questioning why their energy firm isn't asking them for more. But direct debit payments are structured in a way that you overpay in the warmer months to cover the more expensive colder ones. So your energy provider works out what they reckon your bill is for the year, and then they divide it up. So you will have been overpaying over summer, and that is to make up for the fact that you're going to use a lot more in winter. This cutting back to only pay for what you use now is likely to lead to even more problems once the weather gets colder, because you don't have that buffer to help you out. It's also worth noting, for people talking about cancelling direct debits, that the energy price cap is actually slightly lower for people on direct debits. So your energy firm, in theory, by spreading the stuff out, is trying to help you budget. Now, it might be that your payments are suspiciously high, and there have been concerns some of these energy firms are taking in money to like boost their own coffers. So do watch out for that. Do look at them. Do exercise some critical thinking when you look at your energy bills. But beware of this whole only pay for what you use thing, because there's a reason why it's spread out. Economically speaking, there is an argument for doing it, because if you use energy at a price now and then pay for it in the future with money, that money will be worth less than it is now due to the effect of inflation eroding it. However, I'm not sure that that's the argument being put forward by most people for paying their bills. And actually, I think that most people would be in a position where if they didn't pay their bills now, they wouldn't save the money into a separate place and then use it to pay them in the future. They just suddenly find that in a year's time, they've got a £4,000 bill that they can't pay. So don't do that one. Binning your budget. When costs are rising rapidly, life seems increasingly tough. It's really easy to just go, you know what? It's just so hard. I'm not going to bother. I can't even be bothered to try and get on top of things. And that often leads to people just completely giving up on their budget, which I would admit will feel momentarily liberating. Over the longer term, it will lead to financial pain. So now's the time to double down on getting a grasp of your finances, your incomings, your outgoings, working out where your money's going, what you can do, get a budget, don't bin the budget. Stopping paying into a pension. Again, another tricky one. Me and Lee were talking about this yesterday in the office, in that, in theory, if you are absolutely at breaking point, right, and you need that money to pay your bills rather than going to your pension, then it might make sense to divert it away from your pension. But the problem is if you cut back on your pension, you dramatically increase the risk of never starting it up again. This is a classic thing that people do. They cut back, I'll start it in the future, they never start it again. And you're also missing out on free money, the contributions your employer makes, the tax relief that automatically adds 25% to the money that you put in. And don't underestimate the power of automating your saving and your investing and the fact that you will need that money in the future. So just try to avoid cutting paying into your pension if you can. And if you do, just cut it back a bit. Don't cut it back. Don't stop it completely.
I'm going to jump in here defending those who cutting it back, not necessarily because they need it now, but because of sort of fears in the future, which is essentially what I'm doing. So basically I'm backing myself here. I know what it's like to get in quite severe financial distress, having had quite a serious injury and not being able to work. And I know that the long-term financial damage that caused, by diverting all of your money, spare money, we don't call it that, into your pension, you cannot get that out. So you do risk what they're saying about energy bills going up 6,000-7,000 next year, that will push some people really over the edge. And you do risk getting yourself into serious financial difficulty if you cannot afford to pay your bills. So giving yourself that buffer. I agree with you. Don't stop completely, but make sure you have a financial buffer.
Just to say quickly on that, Georgie, as well, there is one point here that needs to be made, is that I am referring to people who are employed here, okay, when I talk about you missing out on the contributions your employer makes, right? And I mean, if you're self-employed, as you are, then that's a different scenario. And for the self-employed, saving into a pension is much, much harder. It's harder to automate, it's harder to do, it's harder to set up. There's a lot more hurdles in the way, and we need to do a lot of work to improve the amount of people, self-employed people, saving into a pension. But I do agree with you. I think the thing that I'm talking about here is for people for whom they're not absolutely at that breaking point, and maybe it's only £100 a month they've got going into their pension, but it's like, before you cut that £100, see if you can cut £100 somewhere else is the point I'm
Lee?
Yeah, no, we were talking about this last week, weren't we, Georgie, about the cutting back on pension contributions, and you know, the pros of saving into a pension for your long term, but also, you know, that money is locked away until your retirement, as you say. And it's quite difficult, as we always say in this podcast, there's no sort of like one size fits all approach. People are in different financial positions, are going to have a varying level of energy bills depending on the property they're in and all that kind of stuff. And I guess the one thing about the pension contributions angle is that trade-off of, if you are in a really quite tricky position and you're thinking about things like borrowing on credit, for example, which could be quite costly in the short term and the long term, I can totally see the logic in thinking about cutting back a little bit on pension contributions to ease the short-term pain. But it obviously then can create long-term pain, as we were discussing the figures last week, weren't we, in the research that was done. But as we were saying, I can totally understand why people might be tempted to do this, but as Simon adds there, if there's any way to avoid it, you know, aka finding ways to cut back elsewhere to try and get through, ride out this storm, that would be, you know, the ideal scenario.
I mean, obviously, you'd like to have your savings pot. We keep talking about this 3 to 6 months, but all I'm thinking with this current situation is it's God, I hate using this word. It's kind of unprecedented in the amount of money that you will need. So that 3 to 6 months savings pot actually looks really minimal right now when I compare it to what might be coming down the line. Simon, sorry.
I was just going to say, look, my point is here is that try to avoid it if you can. And obviously for some people, it will be the absolute difference. But if you are still going out for dinner 3 or 4 times a month, Deliveroo-ing yourself some food 3 or 4 times a month, having, you know, 3 or 4 weekend breaks away a year and all these other things. Like, I'm not saying that people shouldn't do this. I think people should. I was given a talk on this podcast about a month ago about why people should go out and spend money and enjoy themselves and not freak out about stuff, right? Mm. That they should try to keep enjoying themselves. But if you're doing that stuff, if you can cut back on that a bit, right, you're just living your life kind of stuff, mm. enjoying your life. But if you can cut back a little bit on that and keep the money going into your pension, or at least some money going into your pension, that is the wiser move than continuing to go out for dinner four times a month, delivering yourself food every weekend, doing three or four weekend breaks away, and just cutting the money going into your pension. I'm sorry to be a killjoy.
It's all right, Simon. You know, anything else on that list?
Don't stop saving or investing if you can. I mean, I said at the start of what we were talking about here that this is really going to hamper people's ability to save and invest. For most people, it's going to be, okay, well, I just can't at the moment. It's taking up as much of the money. But the benefits of long-term regular saving and investing are immense. Compounding magnifies your gains. Don't stop it altogether, I guess, is my suggestion. Mm-hmm. Just maybe dial it back. Even if you dial it way back, but just keep doing it, because it's better to avoid falling out of the habit altogether. And saving is a habit. Mm-hmm. Lots of things are habits, okay? It's a routine. It's a habit. Some of the, almost all of the things that we, I was listening to, okay, here you go. I'll tell you why I was listening to this. I was listening to a podcast interview the other day, right? It's by a guy called Matt Barr with Stacy Peralta. Stacy Peralta was a very famous skateboarder, one of the founders of Pal Peralta. He's now a filmmaker, okay? And made like a number of like famous documentaries. He's got a new one coming out, a surfing documentary about Jerry Lopez, right? And he said one of these things where he said, like, almost all of the successful things we do in life are built upon a routine, right? Upon imposing some form of routine on yourself. It's like, and that's true of saving and investing as well. It's imposing a routine or a habit on yourself. And so just try and keep a bit of the habit. Even if you know, try and keep the habit, yeah. Even if you don't do all of the saving, is my point.
Yeah. Two books I'd recommend on that. I've just finished reading Atomic Habits by James Clear, and I'd also add Habits by Charles Duhigg to that as well. Lee, have you got any more to add to the list? I'm not talking about books, although if you do, that's absolutely fine as well. We're cultural on this podcast.
No books on the list. I sometimes get my halfway through financial books and then I can't go on anymore. It's just too...
These are not financial. These are behavioural psychology
stuff.
No,
but you know what I mean.
But you can throw some financial ones if you like.
But the behavioural economics stuff, I get sort of halfway through and it's just almost like a busman's holiday and I realise that I just need a complete escape.
I know what you mean.
From the day to day. But yeah, I've got a couple. I would say that one really big one is... comparing only price and not quality. So what I mean by that is, you know, you think you're making financial savings by paying out maybe a little bit less for something when you can get a better quality something for a bit more money and it lasts longer and it's just better. So I've got two examples of that. One of those is shoes, right? I've definitely went through my 20s of just buying, like, you know, pair of shoes for like 25 quid, like the bare minimum, you know, whatever I need for work, and just working my way through those soles so quickly and realizing actually the difference between a £25 pair of shoes and a £75 pair of shoes is that they are probably like at least three times the quality, as in they last a lot longer. And then on a sort of like smaller scale of that, bin bags, Georgie. Now, someone tweeted recently, it was Victoria Bischoff, the Money Mail editor. She recently put out a tweet saying, you know, what's one item that you cannot, one luxury that you couldn't stop yourself spending on, you know, despite the cost of living crisis. And I just tweeted back, bin bags. And it's totally true. I've reached 35 years of age. And in the last couple of years, I've realized that paying a little bit more for some good quality bin bags makes a massive difference in my life, right? Instead of paying like £1.50 for 20 bin bags, paying £3 for 20 bin bags is well worth the financial outlay. And to go another sort of one I would say about this, a false economy, is shopping at pound shops and you know, like bargain stores. I love all those stores. I go into a lot of them. We've got a lot around here. You know, I'm talking about the Poundlands, I'm talking about the BM stores, all of those kind of things. I love going in them. You know, I don't mind. I'm, you know me, George, I'm a thrifty kind of guy. But you've got to know your prices.
And so I go into them and I don't find them particularly
well.
This value. You have to know which is the, you know, each product almost.
You've got to know your prices, because inside there are plenty of red herrings of stuff that's dotted around. You think, you know, actually, I need, like, you know, some washing up liquid, or I need that, or I need that. And you realize that actually it's not any cheaper and potentially actually a little bit more expensive. I feel like they're almost like little mines that have been thrown around the store that you've got to be careful not to just pick up. You think, oh, I need those. Oh, that's probably cheap because they're in a cheaper store. Actually, what I tend to do is I wait for things like, you know, this is so sad, but I don't really care. Things like dishwasher tablets, things like detergent, that kind of stuff. It always goes on offer at some point in supermarkets. And if it's not on offer the time I go, I've always got some in reserve. I'm very much, well, actually, that's on offer, so I'll buy two or three of those. And then I just stick it out in storage out in the garage, and I've paid less for it, rather than, you know, going into some of these cheaper stores. I keep doing them in sort of like my, you know, inverted commas, cheaper stores. You've got to know your prices. And we definitely, I was in one of those shops this week with my wife, and she picked up something. She said, hold on a minute, that's not cheap. And then she's kind of now got obsessed with, like, realizing that these shops aren't all as what they seem. So they're definitely a couple of false economies that I would highlight.
Nice ones. Thank you for that, Lee. Enjoyed that. Right. Oh, Simon?
Sausages.
Sausages?
Yeah, don't ever skimp on sausages. Don't buy cheap sausages. They are massive false economy. Pay up for the high meat content, quality sausages, if you're going to eat sausages, that is, of course.
Yeah.
And just eat less of them. Never skimp on sausages.
Yeah, that's an important one to add there. We could add many more if we're going down that route, but we'll leave it at sausages. Let's move on. Your article, you have an article on your website about renting. It's nice to see, actually, renters are getting a bit more attention of late, I think, being a renter, and it's all about me. It asks, has there ever been a tougher time to be a landlord? To which, as a renter, I would reply, has there ever been a tougher time to be a renter? A renter, which has just been served a Section 21 and is looking for an apartment at the moment, it's hell. Therein lies the battleground between the two. Therein lies the battle between the two. The market is a complete mess at the moment. I've been in it for over 20 years. This is the worst I've seen it. Landlords are selling up, rents are at record highs. There's queues, bidding wars, cash up front, auditions. Something will go on the market. Within literally half a day, it's gone, if not less. All of this commonplace as would-be tenants can't find a place to live at any price. You're looking at increases in places like Manchester of 20%, London over 15%, outside of London on average, I think it's 11% rises. The government have proposed changes to clean it up, to give more powers to tenants. But is the constant meddling from government, arguably, if we go back to 2015 and George Osborne talking about mortgage interest relief, is it that meddling since then that got us into this situation? Simon, we've spoken about this on the podcast when you've been away, but what is your take on the rental market at the moment? Where did it all go wrong?
Okay, my take on the rental market at the moment is that it's quite a complicated picture. And I can see this from two sides. I can see this from the sides of the tenants, and I can see this from the sides of the landlords. And I can see it also, I guess, from the bigger picture. So I see what's going on in the news, and I see the regulatory changes, and I see all the stories that we write. Okay, so I see that side of the picture. I also see the fact that my mum is a letting agent. She runs her own letting agency and has done for the past 35 years, right? Her independent, deals with many of the people who are landlords have been, you know, her clients for years and years and years and years. And her golden rule for all of those landlords has always been, treat your tenants well. You do the stuff that needs doing. You improve the property. And it's always that thing of happy tenants makes for good long-term returns. And I think that there's a lot of that doesn't go on in the buy-to-let market. There's a lot of bigger high street chain agents who just aren't interested in that kind of stuff. They don't care about like people's tenants. And in fact, actually for many years, churn helped them because then they could, you know, charge a few more fees to people. And I think it is a bit of a mess, and it's a bit of a mess partly due to the meddling. But it was seen that buy-to-let landlords had too much of an unfair advantage over first-time buyers. So we had 3%. Well, yeah, because like most of them already own one property. I mean, there is no reality where you can say that there isn't an unfair playing field where someone who already owns a home that they live in gets to then like go buy one that they can then rent out to make profit. And then say, well, hey, look, I'm just in the same position as this first-time buyer who's trying to save all this money to buy a property.
But why do we view it as every single person wants to buy a house?
Well, we don't, but lots of people do. But the problem is that the people who want to rent a house need someone to rent it off. Exactly. And as a result of the changes that have been made, the 3% stamp duty surcharge, the mortgage interest tax relief changes, the extra regulation that's come in to do with various things, the EPC stuff that's coming down the line, the general mood music, the crackdown on landlords, lots of landlords have just gone, well, it's not worth the hassle. And also what you have to remember is lots of those long-term landlords are older, have owned properties for a long time and made a load of money. So they decided to cash in and their chips and take them out. Now, the idea was that that would be great because they'd sell to these first-time buyers who would therefore have a slight leg up on the landlords because they don't have the hurdle to get over the 3% stamp duty surcharge, which sucks quite a lot of money out of the money that people can put down. And then the landlords aren't benefiting in the same way from the mortgage interest tax relief and so on and so on and so on. But of course, the landlords do get interest-only mortgages, right? Buy-to-let mortgages are interest-only, which does make it quite a lot cheaper compared to the people trying to be first-time buyers who are paying repayment mortgages. And also they just tend to be, they have capital. This is the whole problem, isn't it? It's like they have the capital to put down and the first-time buyers don't have the capital because house prices are so high. But you, as I said, you need someone to rent these properties off. And the idea was that we were going to end up with a much more business-like private rental sector, and that businesses were going to step in. We were going to see the rise of build to rent and things like that. And it was just all going to be a lot more professional. Tenants were going to get treated better. And I think arguably that hasn't happened. I think arguably landlords have backed away or sold up. The build to rent thing hasn't really stepped in to make up for it. And in fact, most of the build to rent stuff you see is even more expensive. It's aimed at some kind of like luxury living. You've got a concierge and a gym and a roof terrace and a communal area and higher charges. We haven't seen, you know, what we need to come in. And then we've just, you would expect at the moment, actually rental demand to be lower, because what usually happens is when the sales market is doing really well, the lettings market doesn't do so well. And when the sales market is doing badly, the lettings market does really well. What you've got at the moment is another weird post-COVID scenario where both of them are going gung-ho at the same time. And unfortunately, it falls upon tenants to bear the brunt of that. And unfortunately, that skews towards people who have less money to do so. They earn less, they've got less savings, all this other stuff, because they tend to be younger, because the home ownership principle in this country means that most of the people further up the ladder own mortgaged homeowners or unmortgaged homeowners.
Lee, is it worth it being a landlord anymore, do you think? I hope lots of people do want to be landlords, but I can't see a resolution to this. If you're talking about reversing some of those tax changes, I mean, along with estate agents and journalists, a landlord's not sort of the most hated profession. Can you call it a profession? I think so.
I think you've really, really got to do your homework now if you're getting involved in the... Well, you would have had to do anyway, but especially so now to become a landlord. I think I've always thought to myself that I think I'd hate to be a landlord. I think I'd hate to have to deal with potential, not saying all, but some nightmare tenants. You know, you hear those stories, you know, just bad, occasional bad eggs. You get occasional bad eggs at landlords as well. But I've heard so many horror stories about, you know, homes being trashed and all sorts of being called at different times of the night and all of that kind of stuff for things that are going wrong in the property. for me, I couldn't stomach all that. But I know for a lot of people, you know, they enjoy being landlords, and, you know, they're fair with their tenants. They want people in that are going to be there for the long term, that are going to treat it like their home. It's just whether the figures and the maths and everything stacks up now, you know, given the changes that you were just talking about there, and the EPC stuff that's coming in within the next couple of years. It's just how attractive it is to be a landlord. Now, you think, well, that creates an opportunity, surely, for first-time buyers to be able to snap up these homes. The trouble is, it's a couple of the biggest rental markets are in London and in Manchester and in the big cities across Britain. And the property market is so bonkers, and it's been bonkers for a long time, but it's been exacerbated by the pandemic, in which house prices have gone up astronomically, in which it's very difficult to be a first-time buyer to potentially buy a landlord's home, especially in London and in, you know, desirable areas of Manchester, Birmingham, those sorts of places. So, I don't know, this story is totally true. It's so finely poised. And actually, I don't really know what the answer is and what happens from here. It's quite clear that, you know, in terms of being a renter at the moment, it is a horrible place to be if you're having to move and try and find a new rental property, because as we were saying in the podcast last week, anything that's good quality is going to be snapped up very quickly. People are going to want it, so, you know, it's almost like you have to act fast, which I never think is ideal when you're doing something as massive as moving home, because you want to do all of the checks. You don't want to be having to make fast decisions and just going in sort of blind and going, oh, here's my new rental home. In the same breath, it's also difficult to be a landlord at the moment, and they get a bad rap for, really, I think, because you read the occasional story about, you know, landlords being unfair and they've sucked or hoovered all of these properties out of the, you know, the market and whatnot. But I think there's a case study in this story actually that says it's not all it's cracked up to be. You know, it's not sort of like, you know, being a landlord isn't like, we're not just sitting around like drinking champagne and going, hey, look, you know, but you're paying our mortgage type thing.
They're not all massive in sort of institutional investors. I mean, my auntie is a landlady. She rents out a couple of homes, and that's her pension, because she doesn't have any opportunity
to her.
And a lot, I think most of rentals, are they not just one, the odd one, perhaps you become an accidental landlord?
Yeah, there is quite a bit of that, because you think about it, let's say, you know, you were lucky enough to own a property and, you know, someone else owns a property and you become, you know, you get together and then you're in a relationship, and then, you know, quite often you move into one of the homes and then you become an accidental landlord because the other home can then be sort of rented out. There's quite a lot of that kind of thing that goes on. And I just think that, you know, like your auntie, people like to have an actual asset and think, you know, the property is my pension. Well, look, some people like that, and that's what they like to do. And that's the way that the market is geared up in this country. And I can't imagine there's going to be much else that's going to happen that's going to really change that now. I feel like landlords have had a couple of quite seismic changes in terms of mortgage tax relief and these EPC changes that are coming up. You know, and I talk about these EPC changes, you know, some properties that landlords have already meet these EPC ratings already, but there is quite a lot of properties that don't, and quite a lot of rental properties that will need improving, and landlords are simply just saying, don't want to get involved with this anymore. And as Simon said a little while ago, just cashing in their chips. So it's a really difficult industry at the moment to predict and read what's going to happen next, because the big shift in the pandemic was people, you know, weren't renting as much, perhaps moving back with parents, that kind of thing. You know, there was that kind of exodus of city centres because of not being in the office, yada yada yada. And now we're seeing this sort of like flip reverse of that, where people are trying to move back into cities. And I know I'm not just talking about cities, because there's rental properties all over the country in all different towns and whatever, but it's quite clear that anything that is of good quality that ticks the right boxes in terms of a rental home are being snapped up very quickly, and it's creating quite a testy experience for people that want to rent and need a new home.
Indeed. Simon, how long is it going to last? Just so I know personally here.
Just hopefully not too long, I think.
Yeah.
I think what we're going to see, well, what all the stuff we're talking about, is unfortunately probably going to trigger some form of recession and major slowdown in the economy, and that's going to crimp people's ability to keep paying higher and higher prices for stuff. And so you are ultimately going to see this ease back. But maybe we've got to the point now where the mood music is going to slightly change on the landlord thing, and we're going to ease up on them a little bit. I don't know. It's just not a popular move. Helping out buy-to-let landlords is never a popular move. So, but actually, ultimately, helping
you're
them out
you're
a
helping
bit.
Helping tenants. That's,
helped cracking down on them hasn't really helped tenants, it turns out. So
that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Sam North of eToro for our weekly update on what's been happening on the markets. Sam, what's been going on over the past week?
Yeah, well, yet again, global markets have been on the back foot. The FTSE touched a six-week low at one point, and the pound against the US dollar hasn't actually traded this low since March 2020, which is the pandemic low. Heading into the end of the week, US stocks have been on course for a third straight decline. Recession fears are looming again. We've got a US jobs report today, and that, along with the next US inflation reading, September the 13th, that is, will be so key for markets. I think the Federal Reserve will want to see a poor jobs report, because if they see signs that the economy is struggling, that in turn may help them be less aggressive with their monetary policy. So it might be a case of bad news is good news, but a strong jobs report might be bad for the markets.
Looking ahead to next week, I guess there's going to be a lot more questions asked of whether that was a bear market rally that's come and gone, or whether stocks can really stage a recovery from here on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really getting into the period now where everyone's returning back to the market. It's a lot busier. There's loads more things on the schedule. I mean, on the Monday, we find out the new PM. While I don't think that would be necessarily massively market moving until we actually hear from them, you know, one to keep an eye on. And then, yeah, we've got policy decisions from Reserve Bank of Australia, Bank of Canada, European Central Bank. So it'd be so interesting to see how they deal with this inflation that's spiraling out of control, and whether their actions could then set precedent for the Bank of England and Federal Reserve that come up in the next sort of 2 weeks. So yeah, is it the bear market rally? Do we start to continue higher? Do we come back and print fresh lows? That's going to be interesting to see. It's worth noting September, worst month of the year for stock market historically. But this isn't a normal year, so I think we need to take that with a bit of a pinch of salt. Come September the 30th, we will be higher or lower because of inflation and central bank policy.
Fingers crossed, eh?
Fingers crossed.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that, Sam. And we will speak to you next week.
Welcome back. Now, with energy bills going through the roof at the moment, what will this do for the government's drive to get us to switch to electric cars? The rise in energy comes at a time when we're actually seeing the price of petrol at the pumps come down. So which is cheaper to run now? Simon, well, was it before? Is it now? How do you work it all out?
If you just look at the cost of running the car and ignore the cost of buying the car, which is quite difficult to do because you obviously need to own the car first. But right, just accept the fact that the cost of buying the car is more expensive, but most people buy brand new cars on PCP deals that basically factors in you pay the depreciation over a period of time, and that actually narrows down the price gap anyway, and then they hold their value slightly better. So maybe it won't end up costing you that much more in the long term, but the list price of the car is much more, okay? Ignore all that stuff for 1 minute. The actual cost of running the car. Lots of suggestions that running an electric car is now might even end up being more expensive than a petrol. Not quite is the answer, but the gap has definitely very much narrowed. So under the current price cap, electricity costs 28p per kilowatt hour with a standing charge of 45p per day. October's hike will see this rise to 52p per kilowatt hour, the daily standing charge up to 46p. Now, we took two cars and compared them. Volkswagen ID3, okay, powered by its mid-level 58 kilowatt hour battery, and then a similarly sized VW Golf family hatchback with a 1.5 litre petrol engine. Buying the Golf is cheaper, just to be clear. Now, most home chargers that people have at home, and this is based on people charging at home, are 7 kilowatt devices. So we use that, right? In our worst case scenario, where the electric car owner is paying 52p per kilowatt hour to charge, boosting the ID3's battery to 100% will, in theory, cost £30.67 from the 1st of October, right? Currently, that's £16.69. So it's adding £14 every time you fully charge the car. Officially, that car has a range of 265 miles. under real world driving, you were probably going to get less than this, but we have used that official range figure. The cost per mile for the ID3 is currently 6.3p. It's going to go up to 11.6p. That's a really substantial rise in the cost of running the car. But based on petrol, the Golf is 15.5p per mile. So that is still cheaper than running the petrol powered Golf. Now, you're more likely to get closer to the petrol powered Golf's quoted sort of range on a full tank than maybe you are on the electric car. Although those gaps are, it's not so bad anymore as it once was. But you've got to remember that most electric car owners will have some form of off-peak charging, and so they can charge at night and save money. So that could mean that it brings the cost down. So it's still cheaper to run that electric car. Bear in mind, it's going to go up again in January, but it still is cheaper on a per mile basis to run that electric car. The difficulty for people is if they're then paying to charge on the move, public charging places, that gets more expensive, and it could potentially work out being more expensive to run the electric car. But the electric car is theoretically better for the environment if you conveniently ignore the environmental cost of making the car rather than just running an old one.
Right, which I don't think we can, but no. Never mind. So, I mean, that's the stats there, Lee. But, you know, we are less than 8 years before the government banned the sale of new petrol and diesel cars, so from 2030. Do you think they're going to stick to that? Do you think this will change the way that people think about going electric with energy bills and those sorts of things?
I definitely think it plays in people's minds, because at the end of the day, if it's energy is becoming more expensive and you're charging your car at home and you're not on a specialised rate, because the thing is, there are specialised tariffs for this. You can set it so that your charger at home will charge, you know, in sort of like non-peak hours, so aka overnight, and you pay far less for it. But they've been removed at the rate of knots. It's quite difficult now to get your hands on one of those tariffs. So there's that to think about. And also, electric cars in the first place, Simon was talking about there, the price, you know, the premium that you pay for an electric car over a petrol model is still fairly sizable. And there's a much bigger used market for petrol and diesel motors than there is for, you know, electric cars. So for all those reasons, there's still quite a lot of people that are, I would say, still put off thinking about getting an electric car. And to be honest with you, a lot of people and friends and family that I've spoken to largely are still buying petrol cars, you know, instead of turning to electric. Now, I had an electric car on loan recently. So a little while back, I was sent one to trial. Lovely car, enjoyed it, thought it was really smooth, really easy to drive. I already drive an automatic anyway, so, you know, basically it's just like driving an automatic. It wasn't really that difficult. I don't have a home charger, obviously, because I don't own an electric car. So I took it on a fairly long drive. I took it from Essex into Oxfordshire and back with my toddler, who absolutely loves cars and motoring, and will just sit and watch the Formula One. Age three, just loves it. Not really too sure where she gets that from, because I just see a car as getting from A to B, if I'm being quite frank. But anyway, we went to Oxfordshire. Now, on the purposes of trialing this properly, I charged it on the way there and on the way back, just because I wanted to see what it was like, you know, basically going to a service station and giving it a charge. Now, the first service station that I got to was Beaconsfield, which is basically like a halfway point, and there was a half an hour wait for a rapid charger. I mean, that's mad. I mean, because I'm going to have to wait for the rapid charger in some sort of weird queuing system, and then plug it in, wait for it, and then come back. So in the end, I used one of the slower charging points, and someone who I was speaking to, who helped me, actually, very kind of him, had one of these subscriptions for an electric car. So there's been a rise of this where you can basically have it on a kind of monthly basis, and you pay a fee, you have the car, the insurance, and you can basically just drive it. He lives in a flat and he has nowhere to charge it at home. And he was telling me all sorts of stories about, you know, basically coming to this services station, charging it and bringing his laptop and like doing work at the service station. And I can't think of anything more bleak than that. I mean, that just sounds like, I don't know, that doesn't sound like enjoyment of car ownership to me. And then on the way back, stopped at Watford services, and about half of the electric charging points were broken. So I think that, you know, the key is for this, I think, is being able to get a home charging point installed, which costs money, getting on a tariff where it makes sense, where you can charge this up, and really just crunching all of the figures, doing all of the maths and figuring out whether buying a brand new electric car stacks up, and whether it stacks up now with rising energy prices.
That does not sound a pleasant experience.
I don't want to put people off, by the way. This is not me going, oh, electric cars are absolutely rubbish. The car itself was a fantastic drive. It was lovely and smooth. And, you know, there's no doubt one day I'm going to be potentially driving an electric car. And for some people, it will all work out. There's all sorts of, you can get, for example, tax breaks through your employer potentially, which can make it a little bit more of an attractive proposition. And let's face it, we're not talking about petrol prices much anymore, because we were only a couple of months ago, we were every day we were seeing record petrol prices to a point where it was becoming £2 a litre of unleaded. You know, okay, it's dropped back off now. We're on about 160 around here, 165 maybe. That's still incredibly expensive. And it's still, you know, I'm talking about here going to the petrol station, probably paying 80 to 100 quid to fill up the car. Comparing that to charging up the electric car is going to be quite small if you've got the facilities to do it. And the other thing I would say as well about charging at the service station, I was completely blind. I was flying blind in terms of, I had no idea how much I was being charged for a kilowatt of power and how much it was going to cost me. I just tapped my card, plugged it in. Once it was on 100%, I unplugged it. And then I just got a notification on my bank statement about how much it costs to do it. They could have charged me anything. I had absolutely no idea. I could not find anywhere where it told me how much it's going to cost, basically per kilowatt. And we are, I guess, at a time where we're seeing energy prices go up, as we keep talking about. These services and where you go and plug this in are only going to get more expensive because the cost of energy is going up. I would say if you're someone that's got an electric car and using these charge points, quite often you would have a scheme or a system where you use the same one. So you might have an app and you'll know and all that kind of thing. But if you're just in a casual electric car user, for example, there was someone else there that was had an electric rental car, never driven an electric car before, again, to fly blind, asked me how much it was going to cost to charge. And I said, I've got absolutely zero idea. So there's a little bit of that in that kind of like infrastructure where it still feels like it's still a bit of in its infancy.
Beta, sounds a bit.
Yeah, a little bit. And then, you know, we're coming up now to this 2030 deadline, as you say. Again, people might have better charging facilities near where they live. For example, the BP garage, which is 2 minutes up the road here, a couple of months back, they've installed 4 electric charging points there as part of its BP Pulse sort of service. I think you've got to join that and be part of it. But if you were an electric car owner, it would probably make sense. You would have these schemes and you would know. And that's where I think you've got to research and know what you're doing.
All right, we'll leave that to one side, Lee. Just a quick savings Best Buy alert, if you would. So Investec has boosted the rate on its one-year fix from 2.9% to 3.3% as savers turn to short-term, fixed-term deals as the Bank of England base rate rise pushes them higher. Is this the highest we can get? Is this the best? How's this looking?
It's a million mile an hour in the savings market. you step away to make a cup of tea and you come back and there's a new Best Buy rate. It is absolute savings mania out there. And for that reason, actually, just at the end of last week, we've launched a new savings alert system. So if you go onto our homepage or into any of our savings stories, you'll see a little box there. You can simply put your email address in and we will send you alerts when these Best Buy rates come out. So we saw Investec come out with 3.3% over 12 months, which pretty good deal. You can boost that rate if you go onto a savings platform. So for example, Raisin offering 3.5% exclusively through its website, still FSCS protected, 3.5%. If you do it through our website, you get a 30 quid sign-up bonus, which will boost the rate to about 3.8%. So we're talking about a one-year fix, almost 4%. I mean, that's how quickly the market is moving. So it's well worth looking around, seeing what you can find. But they are the best short-term fix deals at the moment. And as James said in the saving special a couple of weeks ago, please do go back and listen to that if you're a savings fanatic. Basically, they're suggesting that one-year fixes is where a lot of people are heading at the moment, and it's what a lot of people are interested in. Additionally, just yesterday, we have seen Gatehouse Bank come out with 2% easy access. Now, that is the first time that we've had 2% on an easy access account for pretty much a decade, which coming out of my mouth sounds absolutely mad, 2%. And as I said to Simon in the office, well, it's 2%, but you could also look at it as a new Best Buy launches at minus 8.1% when you're thinking about inflation, because nothing is beating inflation in terms of savings at the moment, as we've discussed on this podcast. But it's still, you know, like interesting that we're seeing savings rates rise. And we're seeing 2% from a Gatehouse, you know, again, FSCS protected. We're seeing some banks making upward rises on some of their rates. But, you know, we're still seeing really, really quite poor accounts from the big high street banks, really, on the whole, when you compare to the rest of the market and what's out there. So it is worth shopping around. It is worth hunting around for, you know, it's a false economy. Not going around and finding the best rate, because you think, oh, I know I was mucking around there, so well, 2% is actually minus 8.1% inflation rate. But it's still, you know, negating some of the effects of inflation by at least parking some cash. If you're going to choose savings over investing or whatever else, at least make sure it's in the best rate that you can possibly get at the moment. And rates are going up and up and up and up. That's why we've launched the savings alert system. So, you know, you'll be on top of it all. And I get the impression that we're going to see probably a few more base rate rises, as we've discussed. We're probably going to see savings rates keep climbing, I would say. Don't know how much further, don't know how much and how quickly. I whispered this in the office this week, and Simon was like, oh my God, you are pathetic. Maybe he didn't call me pathetic, but not far. I was like, you know what this all means? There's going to be a cash ISA season next year. There's going to be some good rates coming out. There's going to be some banks looking for some cash. It's on.
It's been a few years, Lee. Your little ruddy face getting all excited.
March to May. Mark it in your calendars now. Just big, big circle. Cash ISA season is back. Because I've put that in my calendar. I don't have a calendar for next year. But you know what I mean.
Well, it's all right. You're a personal finance journalist. You set the agenda. If there's going to be a cash ISA season on This Is Money, there's going to be a cash ISA season. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Lee?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney. And you can also comment in the article in which this podcast lives.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.